From KCPW in Salt Lake City, I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. Solar power has become the focal point in the latest trade war with China and a political football, thanks to the Solyndra controversy. But despite the cloudy headlines, the news for consumers is bright. Prices for solar panels continue to drop, and grants and tax credits are driving more Utahns to install solar arrays on their homes and businesses. While solar remains just a small portion of the alternative energy mix, what's the potential for solar, and how is solar power technology changing? Today on the program, a little sunshine to counter the gray skies outside. Plus, color and how artists use color to evoke emotions and to connect us. All that and your calls after the news. Good morning, I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. While it's still a fraction of the broader energy picture, solar power is gaining a foothold in Salt Lake County and the state. In 2007, 150 residents and just 8 businesses used solar arrays. This year, nearly 4,200 residents and businesses took the solar plunge, and today on the program, we're talking about the allure, the potential, the costs, and the technology behind solar energy. Joining us this hour, Sarah Wright. She is Executive Director of Utah Clean Energy, a nonprofit dedicated to advancing renewable energy and energy efficiency in Utah and the West. And Sarah Wright, thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you for having me here, Jennifer.
Also with us, Benjamin Turner is Executive Director of the Utah Solar Energy Association, which promotes education, public outreach, and policy about solar energy. And Benjamin, thanks to you as well.
Glad to be here.
Later on in the program, the art of using color. But first, solar energy. Are tax breaks prompting you to take a look at solar power for your home or business? What do you want to know about solar technology and its potential? 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. Or you can send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. Huge growth locally in solar energy and a huge interest. As I mentioned, just 158 Salt Lake County homes and businesses used solar 4 years ago. Now we're at 4,200, so tremendous growth. What is fueling the interest? Benjamin Turner.
So solar, of course, is gaining a lot of interest on a countrywide scale, but in Utah, we're seeing a lot of progress in policy, thanks a lot to Utah Clean Energy and the support the association has provided them in pursuing that policy. And then also the cost of solar continues to decline, making it more affordable and still providing the same benefits.
Sarah Wright, is solar for anyone? Is it for everyone? What makes solar a good fit?
Solar is a great fit because you can fit it to your home and to your business. I will say that people should do things to upgrade their energy efficiency as part of their projects, because you don't want to put on more solar than you actually need. You want to make your home or your business very efficient, and then you supplement that with solar power. But anyone can do it.
Solar panels have been around for, 30 years or something? I mean, they were kind of large and bulky. Maybe describe the solar panels of today. What does it look like on your structure, Benjamin?
So solar panels these days are, I mean, it's always kind of a subjective argument, but very slick, very clean. Before, back in the 70s, you're right, they're very bulky and unattractive. But today, they often blend in almost to the roofs that they're installed on. And so many who do so don't complain at all. They think it looks great and don't receive any complaints from the neighbors either.
And when we talk about solar energy, are we primarily talking about solar panels, or are there other elements where we're harnessing the power of the sun?
So when we talk about solar energy, there's really two main technologies that we are inherently talking about. There's solar photovoltaics, there's solar thermal. The former talks about technology that produces electricity from the solar energy that hits it. Solar thermal heats up water, heats up the home, through some heat exchange mechanisms. But those are kind of the two primary technologies we're talking about when we talk about solar energy.
And you would say the majority of residents and businesses are producing electricity.
That is correct. Solar PV has gotten most of the attention because it's generating electricity, which is inherently what people are most interested in. But solar thermal is a very important technology as well.
So if you put a solar panel on your roof, how do you plug that into the power grid or get yourself off of the power grid? How much power is it generating? Is there a right?
Well, so you would size your system. You would put in a series of panels in line with the amount of roof space that you have available and then also your energy demand. So it wouldn't just be one panel. So if you'll look up, you'll see a series of panels on someone's roof. And a lot of it is how much you can afford. You know, it's for some people that use a fair amount of energy, they may not generate all of their energy with solar. They may choose, okay, I'm going to generate half of my power with solar. But then the company, the utility company, Rocky Mountain Power and many of the municipal energy providers allow you to net meter into the grid. So in the daytime, if you're not home and you're generating power, you send that energy to your neighbors. And then at night, you're able to offset that power and use power from the grid.
Mm.
Is one way to do it. You can have a battery backup and be completely off the grid, but many people, the trend is just toward the net metering setup with the utility.
So what happens on a day like today where it's very gray outside, we don't see a lot of sunshine? You're out of luck? I mean, you have to rely on the grid or a battery-generated backup.
You know, solar panels do produce energy when it's cloudy, but not very much.
Mm-hmm.
So you do. You would rely either on the grid or if you had a battery backup. So solar, if you're going to be off the grid and you have a very large battery backup, you can make it work if you want to be completely off the grid. But most people, it's just part of our energy mix. We think, you know, there's solar, there's wind, there's geothermal, there's energy efficiency. So we're not there's not one silver bullet. It's just part of the energy solution.
Is it realistic, though, to say I could generate 50% of the energy that my household uses through solar?
That's very realistic, actually. And going back to what Sarah mentioned earlier, usually if you're wanting to generate 50% of your energy from solar, first you'll take a look at energy efficiency, thereby reducing what we call the load or the amount of electricity you actually consume. And then it becomes actually more affordable to adopt solar to cover 50% of your needs.
Hmm. We're speaking with Benjamin Turner, Executive Director of the Utah Solar Energy Association, and Sarah Wright. She is Executive Director of Utah Clean Energy. And we're talking about solar power. If you have questions or comments, have you installed solar arrays on your home or business? Let us know how it's going. 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. Or send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. What you said that they're not bulky anymore, but what are they made of? How can you describe in general terms how it actually works? How do the sun rays translate to power?
So there's a few parts to the panel. You have first tempered glass, which basically covers the silicon or the semiconductor material, and I'll talk about that in a second. The tempered glass protects the panel. Many people are kind of concerned that maybe some hail is going to damage their panel.
Right.
Actually, tempered glass is so strong that it's not going to. They're usually rated to withstand the forces of hail the size of golf balls without breaking. And so these last a very long time. Underneath that tempered glass, you have a semiconductor material. When the solar or the photons from the sun's energy hits that semiconductor material, through some chemical processes, it actually generates electricity. And then that electricity runs through some wires that are connected to the panel to your grid or to your battery backup system to provide power for your home.
Hmm. Let's go to the phones. And Kevin is joining us from Salt Lake City. Kevin, welcome.
Thanks. I was wondering what your options are if you have a neighbor to the south with a tall, multi-story building, or with large trees.
It's a good question, Kevin, and I think it brings up that more general question of, does your house have to have a certain orientation? Does your roof line have to be steeped, or does it have to be flat? Maybe you can give us some of the specifics of what the physical requirements are for installing a solar panel, solar array that's going to be effective. Sarah Wright?
Well, you obviously need access to the sun, and so you need a southwest, southeast exposure is really the best. South, you'll get the best output. So for this gentleman, if you do have either trees that shade or a building, you are limited. So unfortunately, solar cannot be put everywhere, and I don't know if Benjamin wants to add anything to that. The state does have a solar access law on the book, so that if you are going to put solar on your roof, then you can work with your neighbors to develop an agreement that they will not block that access going forward. But if you already have shade, it is difficult. I've looked for my house, and we have one limited spot where we can do it.
Mm-hmm. Benjamin, anything to add there?
Yes. Excuse me. So kind of about shade is definitely something that you have to consider. Sometimes residences or buildings have a little bit of shade on one side of the home or the building that will impact the output of the array only marginally, say one period of time during the latter end of the day. And if that is the case, you can consider as a potential adopter still putting an array there, but there's actually different what we call inverter technology that will still maximize your performance. I don't want to go into too deep of explanation there, but you have central inverters, you have micro inverters. If you have a central inverter system, it basically wins when shade hits one portion of the array, one panel, it'll impact the performance of the entire array. So drastically lowering your performance. But what you can do is install what we call a small micro inverter on each individual panel. So when the shade hits one panel, it doesn't impact the entire array of panels.
Kevin, I hope that answers your question. Thanks for the call. 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. So I guess if you're looking to see if this is right for your home or business, you have to do this sort of calculus in your head. How much shade you're going to have during the day. If it works for, 4 hours, is it worth it? Is that what you're finding customers kind of doing that calculation, Benjamin?
So, yeah, we do recommend that you kind of get a general idea of things that can impact the performance of your output, like we've talked about here, having a roof that's facing the right direction and making sure there's not too much shade. But at the end of the day, usually it's important to have a contractor come out and do a formal analysis, and they got all the math figured out. They'll be able to provide they'll be able to estimate very accurately how much your array, given the impacts of shading and other various things, can how much it can produce over the course of an entire year. So they'll be able to help you make that decision.
And does the angle of the rooftop, does a flat roof perform better than a pitched roof? Any ideas?
I'll go and talk
there?
About that.
Please.
So yes, it does impact the performance of your array. Flat roofs, don't perform as well as those that are angled. And that is simply because since we are in the northern hemisphere, the sun tends to be south of us, not necessarily right above us. And so if you can pitch your array, it will actually perform better over the course of a year. And that's why it's very typical to install an array on the roof of a home. At that pitch that the roof already has.
Sarah Wright, what's the most common question that your group is getting from consumers, both business and residential? What do they want to know before they take this solar plunge?
Well, first they want to know how they can interface with the utility and how large of system that they'll be able to put in, especially on the commercial front. We just raised it to 2 megawatts, which is a very large system in the last few years. But then they also want to know what incentives are available. And One of the exciting things that Utah Clean Energy has been working on is we've been working with the utilities for a number of years, and we've just, using their data and their model, have just proved that it's cost-effective for a utility ratepayer. So for all ratepayers, it's cheaper for them to provide an incentive for you to install a solar array on your home than it is for them to go out to the market and build a new power plant and provide gas for that power plant.
Mm.
So we just have the data, and now we're working to try to create through the regulatory process a robust program so that everyone can get an incentive, because it is a huge investment, and the utility pays to help you be more efficient, and we hope that they'll start paying soon to help you put solar on your roof.
We're going to talk about the affordability issue in a little more detail after we come back. We're speaking with Sarah Wright, Executive Director of Utah Clean Energy. Also with us, Benjamin Turner, Executive Director of the Utah Solar Energy Association. We're talking about solar and how you can tap in to the power of the sun. 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255, or you can send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. Again, we need to take a break. We'll be right back. This is City Views on KCPW Salt Lake City. Welcome back. This is City Views. I'm Jennifer Napier Pierce. Today on the program, solar power and putting solar into your energy mix. Have you installed solar panels on your home or business? And how's it working for you? If you have questions or comments, give us a call. 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. Sarah Wright is with Utah Clean Energy. Benjamin Turner with the Utah Solar Energy Association here to answer your questions. Let's get to that affordability issue. There is still a perception out there that solar is expensive, and the fact is you do have to spend some money on a project like this. How much does it cost to put solar panels on sort of an average size 2,000 square foot home?
So without any incentives and rebates in place, you're often talking about in the range of about $30,000 for a standard system. But with the incentives, the tax credits, and the rebates that are presently available, that can usually come down within the $15,000 to $20,000 range.
Mm-hmm. And does the investment eventually pay for itself? I mean, what kind of effect are you going to see on your monthly power bill?
So for the first question, yes, it does pay for itself. The panels are rated to, quote unquote, last for at least 25 years. And what that means is that its power output will be at least 80% within 20, 25 years. But you can continue to have that panel stay on there for years past that. And so, yes, it will definitely pay for itself. I'm sorry, Jennifer, what was the second question you asked?
I can't remember. the effect it's going to have on your monthly power bill.
Yes. So it depends on two things. First, if you've completely financed it up front with a cash payment, I mean, your power bill will be completely eliminated so long as you have planned to cover 100% of your power needs or sized your system to do so. What some people do, though, is they kind of finance it, and there's various mechanisms to do so. And so what you're going to see is as a payment that maybe in the first few months or a couple of years might be a little bit more than what you would normally be paying on a monthly basis. But as we see utility rates increasing, definitely within the next decade, you're going to see that financing mechanism being cheaper per month than the cost it would be to pay for your electricity from the utility.
Hmm. Now, Sarah Wright, I understand that one way to bring down the cost is to buy it in bulk. And I understand that you have a program. A lot of residents are taking advantage of this package deal. So describe what this bulk purchase is all about.
Well, this is a brand new program for us, and we're partnering with actually some faith communities. And it's a mechanism where, you go to a bulk store or something, and you buy, the more you buy, the cheaper it is. So what we're doing is aggregating customers that are interested in buying a solar system for their home. And once we hit a certain threshold, we think that we'll need about 50 people that are actually going to go through that. Then you'll put out a request for proposals, and you'll either get a contractor or a group of contractors that come together to bid. And because they know they have a certain volume within a certain geographic area, that will be able to bring the cost down. Mm. And so we're really excited about this project. We're still doing community education, and I think we have about 50 or more people that are signed up. But not everyone that signs up is actually – there's a number of steps that you take. So to get involved, and you can see if it works for you, you don't have to sign the dotted line right away.
Right.
And so that's on our website, and we'll make sure we move it to the front page so that people can see it if they want to learn more about how they could get involved there.
And we'll put a link on ours as well, kcpw.org. One of the things going on in construction is, you know, people say there's a lot of red tape at the city and the county level. How are cities and counties making it easier or harder to get a permit to put a solar panel on your roof? And I guess this is especially pertinent to historic buildings.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is very interesting because Salt Lake City, Salt Lake County, the Utah Solar Energy Association, and Utah Clean Energy just received a grant from the Department of Energy to actually work through removing some of this red tape and streamlining it. So over the next year, we're going to be studying this very carefully and working with West Valley City as part of our partnership at Salt Lake City to see how we could make it work. Salt Lake City has done some work on their ordinances, and you know, I live in a historic home. I mean, solar should not be. There are probably places where solar may not be appropriate. But you just need to have streamlined processes and figure out how you can put it in a way that's aesthetic in some of these areas.
So what are the codes right now? I mean, we're in the process of changing, I'm assuming?
Well, Salt Lake City just revamped their codes. And I'm sorry, I wasn't involved in the process. So I'm not exactly sure how they changed the historic.
Yeah, I'm not sure about that either.
So, but people can call us if they have questions, and we'll help them navigate that. But I know that Salt Lake City is very actively trying to figure out how to protect our historic neighborhoods, but then also enable people to do solar projects.
And other cities in the valley, are they? You said West Valley is looking at becoming more solar friendly. Other cities are doing that as well?
Right, and Park City. It's a matter of making it so a solar designer installer goes to Salt Lake City. They have one permitting process. They go to West Valley City, and they have another different process. And we want a uniform process so that they know what their the expectations are.
Passive solar, natural light have been used in buildings since, gosh, the Romans built the Pantheon 2,000 years ago. How are architects sort of incorporating solar into their designs? Benjamin Turner, are you seeing some trends emerging there?
That's a great question, Jennifer. Yes, there's lots of trends there. In fact, back in September, the association put on a solar tour, which is essentially like a parade of homes, homes and businesses that have solar installed in some fashion. And we highlighted one particular home that had installed solar panels on above a pathway in their backyard. Okay, so we provided cover during the daytime, and half the reason why they did that is simply they did not have the southern facing roof that is a prerequisite to have good production.
So it was kind of a canopy to
exactly,
a walkway. Okay.
Exactly. So that's a really unique way to use solar now, and that is being used in a lot of different ways. In fact, if you Sanyo, which is a major manufacturer, kind of provided panels, not here in Utah, but over, I believe, in China, for one of the buildings they built there, and just covered the entire top of it with solar panels. And it's a very unique looking building. And so, yes, architects are using it now in their design so to help the buildings become more green, more maybe LEED certified, but then also to, of course, drive down the utility costs for those buildings.
Mm. And Sarah Wright, your organization is very focused on efficiency. Are architects using sunlight through just mere windows to help heat homes and to reduce costs that way?
They're definitely integrating those features. In fact, our Office of Energy Development here is in a efficient building, and they have light shelves that bring light further into the space so that they don't need to use as much electricity to just generate their light to work when the sun is shining. So homes build commercial entities, efficiency is gaining ground. It's really the cheapest. First you do the efficiency, because what you don't need to generate is free and there are no environmental impacts. And then you do the renewable energy. And we're excited to see the trends.
Sarah Wright is Executive Director of Utah Clean Energy. Also with us, Benjamin Turner with the Utah Solar Energy Association. If you have questions or comments about solar power and how you might be able to fit it into your energy mix, 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255, or send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. Nationally, the Obama administration has taken a lot of heat over the Solyndra situation. Of course, a startup that received about $500 million in federal loans last year, and this year it went bankrupt. How do you think the Solyndra controversy is going to affect government grants? And do you think that's going to have any trickle-down effect on consumer attitudes toward solar power? Benjamin Turner?
Well, first, the solar energy industry employs over 100,000 Americans presently. And so Solyndra, while it was unfortunate, does not by any means represent that industry as a whole. And so...
So where did they go wrong, and what lessons are Utah companies taking from that?
So Solyndra was a solar manufacturer. They had developed kind of a next-generation technology for solar, but it simply was not cost competitive with the first generation silicon-based technologies that, say, China has really been endorsing and driving down the costs in. So it hasn't been, Solyndra was not able to compete very well. The lessons there are that there are still many different technologies that can be developed. There's a lot of research and development that's going into solar. And there's going to be winners, there's going to be losers, there'll be some that'll be very successful, there are some, just like any other industry, that will go bankrupt because their technology doesn't compete.
So it hasn't shaken the industry as a whole or consumer confidence?
I honestly don't think it's shaken the industry as a whole at all. It's shaken politicians in Washington, but it's not shaken the industry.
Sarah Wright?
I would agree with everything that Benjamin explained. So I was going to go on just to say that the technology is a sound technology. They just bet on a shortage of silicon, which the world supply came up, and they weren't thinking it was going to come up. So they developed a technology that used less silicon, but it's more expensive.
Okay. But you don't think people are going to shy away because of what we've seen in the past few months?
No, I mean, the industry is strong. The technology has been around forever, and it works.
And I should say this, Jennifer, you know, solar has not been adopted in the last few years just because people feel good about doing so. It's because it's made economic sense for them. And so it'll continue to make economic sense for would-be adopters, and that's why we foresee the solar energy industry continuing to do well.
If you'd like to join us, we're talking about solar power. Give us a call. 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. We'll go to Ryan calling from Sandy, Utah. Ryan, hi.
Hi. I have a question about making your home more efficient. Your guests talk about ensuring that your home is efficient as possible before installing any solar equipment. My question is, how best to go about doing that and having your home evaluated?
So I would say one of the first things you can do is start with Questar, their ThermWise program. They do a free audit, and Rocky Mountain Power has an online audit you can do. So you can do a little self-check, but then you can pay to have a full home audit, and I think it's probably around... There was an incentive program, so I'm not sure what it's going to cost post-incentive, but probably at least $200 for a full audit. And they will tell you everywhere that there are leaks in your home. They'll look at your heating and cooling systems and help you determine the most cost-effective things to do to make your home more efficient.
So there are those preliminary checks that you can just do yourself online, but you would advise somebody to call in a professional and do this kind of holistic evaluation?
I would, you might do the individual audit and you see that, oh, my refrigerator is 50 years old, and or not 50 years old, 15 years old, or my house has all these leaks, and you might be able to find things that you can do on your own, or you might think, well, I'm going to, bring in a professional and do the whole thing. We found through the home performance program that the state had that most homes can save 20% of their energy, and older homes, they're finding that they're saving 40%.
Mm. Ryan, are you looking into efficiency measures or even exploring putting solar panels on your house?
Yeah, we are. Just started thinking about this as our hot water heater is starting to leak, and we're thinking about options for replacing that. And someone brought up, and we're also thinking about getting a generator to have around for power disruptions or emergency purposes. And someone started bringing up the issue of solar panels for either of those things.
Ryan, well, good luck. The joys of home ownership. 801-355-TALK is our number. I guess one of the shortcomings of a solar solar energy system is that you can't really store it, can you? Are there mechanisms or is there technology emerging to store the energy that you harvest on a sunny day and keep it for a cloudy day like today?
That's a great question, Jennifer. If you do want to store your own energy rather than selling it back to, selling it, quote unquote, back to Rocky Mountain Power and purchasing it when the sun's not shining, you can set up what's called a battery backup system. So the electricity is generated from the sun, stored in this battery bank, and when the sun's not shining, you can draw upon that battery bank. Usually, though, if you're still connected to the grid, you're actually not going to be drawing upon that battery bank unless the grid goes down. Okay? You usually use battery banks when you're off-grid, but if you want to have a battery bank in the event that there's utility disruption, then it can be set so that when there's disruption, you'll still have electricity powering your appliances. And it's such that it's a seamless process. You don't even notice it happening. It'll switch to the battery bank and your lights will stay on without flickering.
Hmm. Sarah, before the show, we were talking a little bit about the potential of solar power and how, and you mentioned that the utilities are seeing that it's more efficient for, you know, average folks like me to go ahead and install a panel and get a rebate and a tax credit and all that instead of investing in a solar farm. And yet there are some businesses who are interested in developing large solar farms. We have a small one here in Utah, but you said that there is some interest in that in the state.
I know that we've been talking to a couple developers that are looking at very large 50 to 100 megawatt projects where you would put, 1 kilowatt or 1/1000th of that on your home, or 3 kilowatts. And the Office of Energy Development recently reported that there are 8 to 9 such projects that solar developers are trying to develop around the state. So that would be pretty exciting if we saw one of two of those come in the next couple of years.
What would that mean to our energy economy here?
One, it would create a lot of jobs in that area in the construction phase, and a number of jobs for ongoing maintenance. And, you know, with these renewable projects that are scattered around the state, these are usually in small rural communities. So you bring in 6 to 8 good paying long-term jobs, and that's beneficial for those communities. And you may know, Benjamin, more how many it takes to maintain a solar farm.
You know, I'm actually personally not too familiar with that specific information, but at Utah does have a lot of sun, and it is unfortunate that we haven't had as much solar development as we have the potential to have. And so, as Sarah mentioned, it would be great to have even a couple of developers actually get their projects on the ground, because that would really open up the doors for a much more development to begin.
Hmm. We're going to sneak in one last call. Cindy is calling us from Salt Lake. Cindy, hi.
Hi, how are you today?
Good, thanks. Go right ahead.
Yeah, I'm just interested in whether or not, because I'm going to be replacing my water heater, whether to get the on-demand, and do I get one, an on-demand for the different appliances in my house, you know, the showers, the dishwasher, the washing machine, they use it, or do you just use one for your home?
Is this solar related?
It's energy related.
Okay. Cindy, thanks very much for the call. Sarah Wright?
Well, I'll just try to, maybe some of the questions you need to ask is, one, how big is your home? You can get one on-demand system for your entire home, or depending on the size, you may need two. And I would just get bids from experienced contractors, and they can help you decide which is the best track to go. And then I know that some people have even done solar and on-demand, mix the two.
Benjamin?
Yeah, actually, building on what Sarah just said there, we have one of the business members of our organization, Garbett Homes, has actually really been pursuing this solar thermal with an on-demand water heater combination. So the solar thermal system heats your water, so you're not paying for any natural gas to do so, but only heats it up to a certain degree, say 80 degrees, and then to bridge that last 20 degrees, when you turn on your shower, that on-demand water heater will make up the rest. And at the end of the day, you're saving yourselves a lot of energy costs.
Mm. Cindy, thanks for the call. We've only got about a minute left, but solar energy is becoming a major component of the nation's energy policy. Earlier this year, Energy Secretary Stephen Chu unveiled the SunShot initiative to encourage more research into solar power. I guess my question for each of you is, where do you see things going from here in terms of solar? And is it going to get cheaper for consumers, easier, a little more affordable? What's on the horizon?
So I would say that over the next decade, the SunShot, for our audience to explain, SunShot is the DOE's effort to drive down the cost of solar by about 75% from its current cost by 2020. Okay, it's kind of built off of John F. Kennedy's moonshot program back in the 60s to get a man on the moon. And as a result of that effort and just the cumulative efforts of everybody involved in the industry, we can expect a significant decrease in the cost. We can, expect through the efforts of the partnership Utah Clean Energy and Utah Solar Energy Association, various jurisdictions in the state are working on to make it easier to adopt in terms of streamlined permitting processes, all of that. So there's only a bright horizon for the solar industry.
And I guess for you, Sarah Wright, should people wait until it's even cheaper? I mean, that's always the argument. Oh, computers are going to get even cheaper and more powerful if you wait 6 months. Your iPad is just going to take over the world. Should people wait, or is now a good time to make that investment in solar panels and arrays?
Well, I think right now there's a 30% tax credit. We're hoping to get the solar incentive through in the next year. I don't think there's a need to wait. As solar has come down 50% in the last year or so. It's an excellent time to invest, and eventually those other incentives may not be there. So I would say go for it.
Sarah Wright, she's Executive Director of Utah Clean Energy. Thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you, Jennifer.
Also, Benjamin Turner, Executive Director of the Utah Solar Energy Association. Benjamin, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
And there will be a forum, Solar Power 101, happening at the City Library tomorrow night. That's Thursday, December 15th at 7 o'clock. We'll have details on that event on our website, kcpw.org. Coming up next, we're talking about color in art. But first, a break. This is City Views on KCPW, Salt Lake City. Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Napier Pearson. This is City Views. Artists have used dyes and tints for millennia, but why? What effect does color have on our moods, and how do artists use color to convey a message? An exhibit at the Utah Museum of Fine Art explores the relationship of color to artists and audiences. And joining me now to talk about the exhibit, simply titled Color, is Annie Burbage-Ream. She is the Art in a Box coordinator at the Utah Museum of Fine Art, and she joins me in studio. Annie, thanks so much for your time today.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us, Tracy Matthews, Teacher Resource Coordinator at the UMFA, and together they helped create the Color exhibit. Tracy, thanks to you.
Thank you.
And the exhibit Color is nearing its end, but there are still a few weeks to take it in. You can find it at the UMFA on the University of Utah campus through January 8th. We'll have more details on that later in the program. If you'd like to join us, how does color move you? You can give us a call, 801-355 855-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255, or send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. What is color? Maybe you can start from that very basic statement, introduce us to color theory. Annie?
Well, color theory is the way that artists use color in their artwork. It's a way that colors affect each other, and they create sort of this dynamicism when you put them next to each other.
Okay, so colors play off one another, is that what you're saying?
Yeah, they can play off one another. They highlight each other. They affect each other in different ways, yeah.
We hear about warm colors, cool colors. What exactly does that mean, and why do some colors affect us so differently?
Well, I think that we automatically, we have a lot of, when we see color, we have an immediate reaction, we relate to it, we have a lot of things that we attach to specific colors. And so I think that color carries a lot of symbolism, not only, of course, that's shared, but also a lot of personal symbolism.
Give us an example.
In the exhibit, for example, we have a beautiful piece by Jay Johnny, who's an American Indian artist. He's a Canadian artist titled Bella Kula Sun. And the image, it's a print, it's of a sun, but the primary color used in it is a dark blue, a kind of a vibrant royal blue. So that cultural significance, that right there, from his background, using that kind of color symbolism with the sun, I think is a perfect example of how each culture, each individual relates to color.
Hmm. Talk about the evolution of color in art. I mean, we started out using, bark, plants to make dyes. Where have we gone from there?
Well, one of my favorite stories I like to tell kids when I go work with them in the classroom talking about color is talking about where the color purple comes from. And the color purple initially came from a shell called a Murex purpura shell, which is where we get the word purple. And it's this beautiful little white shell, and the inside is purple. And they would actually collect thousands of these shells. And they
on the beach.
On the beach or in the ocean, yeah. And they would scrape out the inside, which is a purple color, and then they would grind it up and use it for dyes for clothing. And because it would take so many shells to, you know, get just a tiny little bit of dye, of purple dye, only royalty could really afford purple, which is why we really associate the color purple with royalty, or at least, you know, the older people do. I think kids now sort of think of Disney and red. But so purple was always a royal color, and it's because it was so expensive from coming from the shells. Mm.
The materials that you apply color to, you mentioned that dyes were used for fabrics. How does color change the way it's perceived, the way it looks when you put it on paper or on a canvas? I mean, did you look at the interplay with color and texture in your exhibit?
Well, Tracy, with all the pieces, we organized into three different areas. And it all relates to kind of basic color theory of the complements. So we have, for example, one area that focuses on artwork that primarily uses orange and blue, and then another area focuses on red and green, and then the third area focuses on kind of purple and yellow. And of course, then within that context, there's certainly a lot of play that happens between secondary and tertiary colors that are used in that area. So I think that when you're viewing the exhibit, it's really fun to just see the play of those of the dominant colors in the artwork, and then those secondary colors, and how those kind of play into the effect of reading the artwork and how it makes you feel.
Hmm. We're speaking with Tracy Matthews, the teacher resource coordinator at the Utah Museum of Fine Art. Also with us, Annie Burbidge-Ream. She's an educator at the UMFA, and the exhibit Color is now on display through January 8th, and you can find more information on our website, kcpw.org. Your exhibit does put these colors into different groupings. Why are they called primary colors, do you know?
Because you have to use red, yellow, and blue to make any other color. You know, we start with sort of those main primary colors to mix and to make other colors.
So how are you using these groupings as a teaching tool, a learning experience? Annie?
Well, I think what's so interesting and striking when you first walk into the exhibit is just the brightness and the vitality of the exhibit itself. And although there's, you know, over 20 works from our permanent collection installed in the exhibit, you sort of that sort of is secondary, because when you first walk in, you sort of see it as one big giant installation, because you have these objects that are grouped salon style on these bright, vibrant walls with the three different colors of the primaries and the complementary. So it really is striking as being one sort of educational or installation piece versus the individual works on their own.
You mentioned that these are pieces from your permanent collection. How did you go through the process of selecting? It must have been kind of fun.
Yeah, that's the fun part. We got to spend some time down in our collection. You know, we go down into the bottom of the museum, into the basement, and we just got to search through and see what we thought would work best and what sort of struck us as far as the colors were concerned.
Can you tell us about some of the other artists who are showcased in this color exhibit, Tracy?
Yeah, definitely. Like Annie said, we selected from a variety of different areas of our collection, which was really fun and exciting. So the exhibition has highlights from a variety of cultures and times. So, for example, we do have a number of modern American artists like Robert Motherwell, Alex Katz, and Anna Campbell Bliss. But then we also have a few works. There's, for example, one work by a Utah artist, a young Utah artist. We collected her artwork while she was a student at the University of Utah. We have a historical piece. In fact, let me find the... It's by an unknown artist, and it's a Flemish painting. It's a very, very traditional portrait. So it kind of gives you an idea of just the variety in the show itself.
It is interesting. You think of the modern art movement of the 60s and 70s, and you think of very vibrant colors, but less so when you go back in time. Has the artistic tradition changed over the centuries, the way artists have used color in their artwork, Annie?
Yeah, I think color has gone from, you know, being a part of an artwork to actually being the subject of the artwork itself. You know, lots of our modernists love to use color as sort of the subject and to talk about how colors reflect and, you know, affect one another next to each other.
This exhibit doesn't just invite interpretation of the art. There's a hands-on element to it. Talk about that hands-on component and why you decided that was an important part of the exploration of color, Tracy.
Well, overall, I think that the color theory and the underlining kind of intellectual side of color is actually kind of downplayed. I'd say overall the exhibit is a little bit more lighthearted and kind of a more simple look at color. And we wanted it to be welcoming for all ages. And so we did include an interactive area where you can actually experiment with some of the artwork and kind of change some of the elements in the artwork to different colors to kind of see how, for example, that the Flemish, very traditional portrait, how his vest would look if it was magenta, for example, or more of a modern color that you would not see in an artwork like that. And so we wanted to include elements in the exhibit that would be really fun for younger kids. We also have a book table where we have a number of different books for younger children about color. There's also a panel that includes some color wheels that you can actually turn and kind of discover more about color theory by playing with those.
How have the kids who have come to the exhibit, or their grandparents or whoever, how is this exhibit being used? Do you have any fun stories to tell there?
You know, we've just gotten some really great feedback. We, Tracy and I were working in the classroom, which is adjacent to the education classroom, just the other day, and this woman came in and said, "I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I just wanted to tell you I love this exhibit so much. It's so fun and interactive and educational," and she wanted it to be a permanent installation into our gallery. So, yeah, we've gotten some really great feedback about it.
So how are you encouraging people to look at color in a different way? What do you hope they take away from this experience in the gallery?
Well, for me, color is around us all the time. It surrounds us, and hopefully it'll maybe just make people more aware of it and more open to how colors affect us and how we in turn use color to maybe express how we're feeling or as a symbol or to spark a memory.
Mm. And Tracy, final thoughts?
Yeah, I just wanted to add that so... although this exhibition is not a lasting installation in the museum, we have used this to help us inform curriculum that we developed for our Art in a Box program, which is actually being distributed across the state. And in fact, Annie could probably talk more about details on that program. But we hope that this exhibition has a lasting effect in the classrooms across the state.
Just very briefly, Art in a Box, what is that?
Art in a Box is our educational outreach program. We go out into schools statewide. We travel throughout the whole state. And the Art in a Box program provides free art instruction. It provides art supplies as well as curriculum-based materials to help transfer classrooms into art studios. And so we go out and we work with teachers and students, and then we leave them a bunch of resources, in this case all about color.
The color exhibit will live on. The exhibit Color, nearing its end, but still a few weeks to take it in. You can find it at the Utah Museum of Fine Art on the University of Utah campus now through January 8th, and we'll have a link on our website, kcpw.org. Annie Burbage, Reem, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Also, Tracy Matthews, thanks to you.
Thank you.
City Views is a production of KCPW News. Jesse Ellis, our technical director, and Ryan Cron composed our theme music. And you can continue the discussion online at kcpw.org. Next time, Utah's political caucus system and an effort to try and change it. Join us for that conversation tomorrow. For City Views, I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce.